Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. People around the world are communicating more frequently than was humanly possible before the digital age. Email, tweets, texting, and other forms of electronic communication have taken over. The actual letter, handwritten or typed or word processed, is going the way of the 3-cent stamp. Just ask the Postal Department as it bathes in red ink. What is being lost or being gained in this transformation? Today's historians warn that their successors will lose a valuable resource. How much would we know about our republic's early days without Abigail Adams' letters? Lincoln's letters give a special insight into the history of his time. How did Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail change history? And does a tweet beat a handwritten love letter? I'm Don Marsh. Author Simon Garfield traces the history of letter writing in his new book, To the Letter, a celebration of the lost art of letter writing. He joins us from London. With me in studio is Chris Gordon, the Director of Library and Collections at the Missouri History Museum. Simon, Chris, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, hi, Don. Nice to be talking to you.
Yes, you're loud and clear from London. Glad to hear that, Simon. You know, it seems to me that you concede in the title of your book that letter writing is, in fact, a lost art.
Well, it's certainly, if it's not dead, it's certainly on its last legs, I fear. I mean, people will always write letters, but in terms of the heyday, in terms of the value that we place on them, and that's as great as ever. In a way, I think we're going through a sort of golden age of letters, but it's a very last hurrah. So over here, we've had some fantastic books which have appeared in the last month. We've had a great Hemingway collection, a new T.S. Eliot collection, and Paul Cézanne's letters. But I kind of wonder whether or not we'll get this kind of thing in 100 or 150 years' time, and I doubt it, really. So the idea of the book was to sort of, celebrate what we've had, going all the way back to ancient Greece and Rome, and then and to kind of ask questions towards the end. Is email going to fill the gap, or are we just going the way of texts and tweets?
So what do we lose if, in fact, that is the case and continues to be the case?
Well, I think we lose two things, and I know Christopher would agree with me on one of these. In the main, I think we lose a depth of writing. When we write a letter, we sit down. It's a very certain act. We get our pen out. We get paper. We have maybe a postage stamp at the ready, and we have what I call in the book a slower cerebral whirring, which I think is, We put a layer together of news and information, opinion and emotion, maybe that we've gathered over a week or two or longer, and we write in a very kind of full and thoughtful way, in a way that we don't if we dash off an email. Now, obviously, we can write longer, thoughtful emails as well, but they tend to be instant. People tend to get upset if you don't reply to an email, within a day or so. And obviously, that doesn't apply to letters. So there's a way we write. Obviously, I kind of don't think we're going to find many love emails in attics, in the coming years. So I think we tend to sort of submit our emotions, if you like, to letters in a way we wouldn't to emails. I think, even before all the kind of Edward Snowden revelations, I never quite trusted emails, not insofar as I kind of thought, someone's going to be reading them, but I just kind of thought, do I want to commit my, my inner thoughts to pixels and digitization? I thought no. So that's one. And then the other one is, the great sort of lost to history, I think. The big question that a lot of archivists are now asking is, how are we going to archive our future history? We can obviously store emails. We can print out, you know, Twitter timelines of things that we've done. But I think that's, I think if we bother to do that, if things don't get lost behind firewalls and, you know, if we can access passwords after someone dies, all those ifs, then are we going to be left with the same sort of thing as if we would have found a cache of letters? And I think not.
I want to turn to Chris, but I would just suggest to you that there are a lot of people who think that email in and of itself is in the process of being swept aside by Twitter and by texting, even shorter communications.
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly agree with that. I mean, I have my kids, and obviously if you survey your own kids, it's not the most scientific survey you can conduct. But, I mean, they regard emails very much now as something of their past, which is extraordinary. They have their Facebook pages open, and they text, and they tweet, and they think that emails are too much of an effort. You know, they're too formal. You have to write them in a fairly formal way as well. And what they love about, you know, the other forms of communication is that they're very instant, they're very chatty, they're very, they're very much as if you have the person sitting next to you in a bar, and they kind of love that. You know, I think the great kind of fear, you know, when social media began, and especially things like Facebook, people kind of thought, oh gosh, you know, young people are just going to spend all their time, you know, locked up in their rooms, and they're never going to go out and see their friends. And now we know the opposite is true. Actually, there's more communication, there's more organization of parties and get-togethers and, you know, meetings and everything else. But I think in terms of you know, the what we leave behind in terms of the written word, even in a digital format, is far less than it was perhaps even 10 years ago.
Well, Chris Gordon, I know all of this is of concern to you, given given the business you're in and your special interest in history. What's your take on all of this?
Well, there's two things. Simon mentioned the emotion that goes into letters. And one thing that we miss in the digital formats that we see now is the strikeout. Sometimes what was left out or what was stricken out of a letter, you know, said a lot about the emotion that was there. Now with delete buttons, that's gone. You know, the draft is the final product, what you see. And also, you know, with as far as preserving these letters, you know, the migration and format and the software and all this, that changes so fast that it's a nightmare, really, to try to get a handle on all this and think that so much of this stuff is going to be lost simply because the technology changes so fast.
What in the world are the historians of 50 years from now, or certainly 100 years from now, going to use as their source material? Because as you well know, and most of us know, so much of it comes from letters.
Exactly. And unless, you know, we come up with some kind of really fail-safe cloud system or long-term storage system for digital records and electronic records, it is going to be very, very difficult to go back and try to piece all this stuff together. You know, we can rely on video to some extent, but again, you do not get the emotion, you don't get the details that you'll get in reading a correspondence.
But Simon, you could not have written this book without having had access to letters going back a great many centuries.
No, I mean, obviously, Don, it's quite hard to write a book about the history of letters without letters. Of course, you're right. And I wanted to show, you know, from the Greeks and the Romans kind of onwards, you know, how little, in a way, that we've changed. You know, so I talk about a fantastic discovery of letters at Vindolanda, which is about a mile south of Hadrian's Wall in the north of England. And this cache of letters, well, it's still being discovered, but it began to be unearthed in these perfectly preserved condition in 1973. And these are extraordinary things, not only because they tell us about how the Romans lived their life in Britain, but also about how similar they were to us and how they had so many similar concerns. So, for instance, there's the most famous one really is an invitation to a birthday party, and it's sort of, it's, you know, please come, I'll understand if you don't, you know, but, you know, it'll be great to have you there. And then there were ones from Roman soldiers writing back saying, you know, we are freezing here in Britain, please send blankets and more beer. That was that appeared on more than one. So you think, so it kind of absolutely, you know, keeps you in touch with the past. I mean, obviously one thing that, you know, we haven't mentioned, which is obviously kind of key as well, and not all letters are written this way, is handwriting. And that again, you know, the Chris talking about the deletions and, you know, sort of choosing new words, which we obviously don't get in email because that all disappears. But the, you know, the idea of being able to not only tell someone's character through their handwriting, but being able to tell, you know, whether they were in a rush. Maybe if it's a love letter, there'll be tears. Maybe there'll be a scent of perfume. You know, all those kind of things. The materiality and physicality of letters, I think, are so important as well. And that's not even to mention, you know, the great delight that one feels. I don't know about you guys, but I sort of groan when I have more emails, and you know, and I kind of, oh, you know, your computer kind of pings again, and you think, well, hopefully it's good news, or hopefully it's something interesting, but often it isn't. And you know, but I certainly don't, and perhaps people probably in Victorian times kind of felt like that about letters, you know, not more letters to reply to, I can't believe this. You know, now any handwritten letter I get, I kind of think, I you know, my heart leaps, really, because I kind of think, okay, this isn't a bill, this is you know, something personal from someone I know, or at least someone who is expressing some sort of you know, unique and personal thought, and just the, you know, I anyway, so I'm sort of getting, I'm wandering off all over. But I mean, you asked me about the, you know, about the kind of history, and you're absolutely right. I mean, as you said, you know, the top of the program, you know, we couldn't begin to tell the history of, you know, the 16th century, 17th century onwards, you know, when people really began to write letters in earnest, in anything like the sort of depth or detail. And I think even with, you know, even if we do find, you know, the perfect sort of iCloud solution where everyone writes the same way, you know, I can only repeat that I think we may somehow be able to, you know, put everything on, you know, the biggest, essentially, you know, the equivalent of the biggest hard drive in the world. But actually, are we going to be left with the same sort of, you know, same sort of, you know, depth and detail? And I don't think we are. And I think that's sort of the biggest loss. It's kind of, you know, I was aware when I was writing the book, incredibly obvious. This is, you know, we are not writing letters, and yet it's almost too big to imagine a world without letters. So it's almost something it's such a big thing. And I'd use tech as much as anyone else, use emails all the time, but I kind of think this is something that has sort of crept up on us over the years, and I think the loss is huge.
I have to take a break, but I want to come back and talk more about how the system worked hundreds of years ago with regard to writing letters and having them delivered, obviously quite a bit differently than the way they're done most recently. My guest in London is Simon Garfield. He's the author of the book To the Letter. Joining me in studio is Chris Gordon of the Missouri History Museum. We are obviously talking about letters, and you'll hear a couple of letters, excerpts from a couple of letters that are 150 years old in just a little bit when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation on the lost art of letter writing. My guest in talking to us from London today is Simon Garfield. He's the author of To the Letter, which examines the history of letter writing. Chris Gordon of the Missouri History Museum joins me in studio. We'll continue that conversation in just a moment, but here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The U.S. Department of Justice is investigating the St. Louis County Family Court. The agency says it's focusing on whether the court provides due process for all children, regardless of race. A new project is being launched today which will study the possibility of consolidating more services provided by St. Louis City and County. Better Together is a grassroots project sponsored by the Missouri Council for a Better Economy. It will examine how municipal services are delivered to people and look at best practices. And 13 Illinois counties are now part of the state's disaster declaration. Governor Pat Quinn has added Douglas, Jasper, Pope, Wabash, Wayne, and Will counties. The others on the list are Champaign, Grundy, LaSalle, Massac, Tazewell, Washington, and Woodford. The designation is aimed at making it easier for state resources to help hard-hit communities. You can hear more about these stories and more this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day on stlpublicradio.org. Now, back to our conversation about letter writing. Simon, I come back to you before turning once again to Chris Gordon. A couple of things come to mind as part of what you were talking earlier about the letters found near Hadrian's Wall several hundred years ago. What were they written on, and how would they have been delivered in that era?
Well, they were written on bark, I think, on alder and elm. The glory of them really is they were preserved because they had exactly the right anaerobic circumstance, sort of beneath heather and bracken and various other things, and they were delivered by other troops, really, by kind of personal messenger. There was no, it's interesting. I mean, we would now regard it as a terribly kind of primitive mail delivery system, but there were actually it was quite well ordered from Rome that you would travel a certain amount and then you would change horses and then you would travel on and maybe be in some sort of chariot and then the post would go on and it would that's how we got the word post because you would go from one post to another so now we would say well obviously it could take we're talking about days or weeks and a lot of mail wouldn't get there and it might be soaked when it arrived and stuff, I suppose as we know, the Romans were efficient folk, and they would have regarded their postal system as second to none.
A forerunner of the Pony Express here, obviously, if they were transporting mail that way. You take it back though through the days of Cicero and Seneca. Same thing. I mean, this is a relatively common era, things written on bark and delivered the same way?
No, I mean, they would then write on sort of primitive forms of, well, I guess it is a sort of bark, I mean, primitive forms of paper and vellum. I mean, it's interesting, if you look at letters from the ancient Greeks, they were very concerned with how they would be regarded, and scholars and librarians and philosophers were very, very keen to record their letters and copy them and make sure that future generations would have them. But they tended to be very rhetorical. They were essentially letters of kind of oratory. They were things that you would read out, at a public arena somewhere. It was only in Roman times, so we can say, 2,000 years ago or so, that letters tended to be kind of more personal and, the sort of more of the sort that we would recognise. And I quote at length, in fact, the first letter I quote at great length is from Pliny the Younger, and his eyewitness description of Vesuvius erupting. And he wrote this actually several years after he witnessed it, after a request from the historian Tacitus that, he gave an account of his uncle's death in Vesuvius. And it was an extraordinary account, because it's, vivid even now, and you read it as a reader, and it's like a page-turner. You absolutely want to see what happened next. He talks about a cloud and then them going to explore and then them withdrawing and, all this kind of stuff. But it's also incredibly valuable, priceless, because it's the only account that we have. And without this, letters as a testament to history, if it hadn't been copied out further, we don't actually have the full Tacitus history, but we do have this letter, and it's the only evidence that we have of the only written evidence, I should say, that we have of the eruption.
Is there, in all of your research, and I want to bring it into the more modern era to get Chris back into the conversation here, but in all of your research, is it possible for you to identify the most important letter?
Well, of course not. No, I mean, if I had to be put on the spot, if you're putting me on the spot,
I
would say that one. Okay, I would say that one. I'm afraid I've already spot the ending in a way. You know, it's sort of I'd say that was the single most significant letter. There are, I mean, the other sort of slightly kind of personal answer would be to say, oh, you know, the last letter I wrote, or the letter that my wife wrote when we first met, or, you know, those kind of things. I mean, in a way, that's, you know, they say that about the camera, you know, the best camera is the one you have with you. And you could say that with letters. You know, the most significant personal letter to us is the one that changed our lives. Maybe it's the letter in which we received our exam results and heard that we got into the college that we wanted, or maybe it's a love letter, or maybe it's, you know, terrible news about the you know, the death of a loved one, or something like that. So everyone will have something that sort of held them in their, you know, sort of held them in their tracks, you know, and made their heart stop for a minute.
Each of us has a most important letter, I'm sure. Let's go back to Chris Gordon now from the Missouri History Museum. Chris, what kind of a collection do you have of letters? Do you have at the museum?
Well, we have letters primarily from the 19th and 20th century, although we do have some correspondence that goes back to the 18th century. And this is, you know, primarily letters to and from individuals, some business correspondence as well. But certainly the most interesting stuff is, you know, the everyday letters, you know, the letters from, you know, folks that went out west and they're writing back home to tell them of the journey across the plains, or the opposite direction, you know, coming from, you know, back east, or, you know, politicians talking about the issues of the day and you know, how they were affecting the everyday individual. So it's, you know, there's all kinds of information in the archives, political, business, personal, but you always have that very personal element to it.
And they really do offer a keen insight into the day in which they were written, the era in which they were written.
Exactly. And, you know, you can't get any better source than a primary document source, you know, whether it's, you know, doing your own family history, genealogy, and reading over a letter, and, you know, you can certainly get an idea of what your ancestors, you know, what their character was like, what their personality was like by reading these letters.
From what I've seen, and we'll listen to an excerpt from one from Nellie Blow in just a minute, from what I've been able to discern, though, from those that I've read, is that they're very much then, they are very much then, 150 years ago and longer, as we are today.
Oh, exactly. I mean, people really don't change all that much. Yeah. You know, you see very common traits, very common characters in these letters, and it allows you to identify with them, definitely. The letter from Nellie Blow is a great example because, you know, Nellie was, she's a young girl, 14, 15 years old, and in this letter, you know, she has this occurrence that is horribly embarrassing.
And what was otherwise a fairly routine thing, moving from one place to another by coach.
Exactly, exactly.
Right. Let's listen. Maria Altman of our news department reads an excerpt from this letter. Let's listen to Nellie Blow.
We got into the stage, which was then filled with passengers. The driver said it was 9 miles. After getting myself fixed as near the driver as possible, where there was the best chance to get my head of the stage, I made up my mind for the worst, as I knew I should be very sick. Unluckily, there were no windows in the stage. We had not gone very far before I began to feel very dizzy, and very soon after, I lost all my breakfast. The passengers were all staring at me, and one old farmer said, "That little gal seems to be very sleepy." I thought I could have done anything to that man. I was so sick that I could not hold my head up, and I occasionally shut my eyes. I never shall forget my stage ride to Oxford.
Maria Altman reading an excerpt from a letter from Nellie Bloh more than 150 years ago. Comment on that, Chris?
Well,
apologies, by the way, to the lunch hour crowd.
Well, you know, it's this letter tells you a number of things. First of all, you know, just that teenage girls are basically, you know, the same then as they are now. But also it tells you a little bit about the transportation system, certainly, in the mid-19th century. You know, people basically take advantage of the fact that we have very nice, smooth roads nowadays. And back then, the roads were horrible. You know, they were muddy masses when it rained. It was, you know, dusty when it was dry, and certainly they were full of holes. And you can certainly understand why she would have gotten ill riding over these bumpy roads.
There's a postscript to that letter too, which we'll air in just a second, which I think is indicative of the comments of a lot of people who are writing letters by hand then and even today for those of us who still write letters. Here's that postscript.
P.S. Excuse this bad writing. I have written in a great hurry, and it was not light when I came down, and I could not see the lines. I have blotted my paper, too, but I cannot help it, so please excuse this line, and I will not do so again. I thought I have written 12 pages. I have not said at all what I want to, and I have not told you half what I have to say. Nellie.
Nellie Bloh, 12 pages. some letter.
Yeah.
Well, and a lot of people had that problem because you didn't have the ability to erase electronically or otherwise. You'd poor handwriting or, as we indicated earlier, a poor choice of words.
Yeah, and also you had to realize that paper was expensive, especially further back you go. And so, you know, people probably could have gone on and on if they wanted to, but they were limited by, you know, the resources they had.
Simon, a 12-page letter, and that, as I have said, is 150 years ago. Are letters of such length common or uncommon as you looked at them through history?
Well, I mean, you know, Chris just raised an interesting point. I mean, paper was expensive, but it obviously cost you more to post a 12-page letter as well. I'm not entirely sure whether the American postal system was the same, but after, you know, the 1840s, when a universal kind of cheaper postage system came in, and we had postage stamps, and the delivery system really got its itself in gear. Over in Victorian England, you had to pay per page pretty much, and it's an extraordinary thing. And so people, you know, would write. And even before that, it cost a lot per page, or if you had two pages, it cost twice as much or whatever. So we had this terrible thing, which you will see in, you know, Jane Austen's letters, for instance, where, people cross-wrote letters, which meant that you wrote one way and you tilted the page 90 degrees and wrote across it, which if you were used to that person's handwriting and you got a lot of letters from them, that was sort of fine. But for us now, it's really hard work. And that was a sign of the times. Long letters. I mean, 12 pages. I mean, I saw a little, thanks to you, I saw a digital image, and obviously they're quite small pages, and she has a lovely, very characterful handwriting, Nellie. So I imagine if she wanted, she could have written a smaller scrawl and you know, a larger paper and kind of all of that. But I know not really that common. Most of the letters that I've seen tend to be, you know, two or three pages, maybe four or five. But that was because it was such a common thing as well. You know, it wasn't. I don't know how often Nellie wrote back to her mum. But, you know, obviously people used to write in the heyday every day or every other day. So there was no reason often to write such a huge letter because you would do it, you know, almost, dare I say it, like we would do kind of emails now.
You know, let's... I'm wondering why we would preserve a letter from a Nellie Blow. Who the heck was she that we'd hang on to one of her letters all this time?
Well, it's interesting that because I'm fortunate to be a trustee of an organization in the UK called the Mass Observation Archive. And this began, I mean, I'm sure some of your listeners will be familiar with it. This began just before the war, and it was the first really big social survey in Britain, which asked people, purely self-selecting, to keep diaries and journals during the war. And it's now a fantastic resource of the way people thought about the war, the way they conducted their lives. And they would write, and this was sort of a bit like Nelly saying, you know, I'm really sorry about my handwriting. And they would write all this kind of stuff. And they would also say, who on earth is actually going to be interested in this detail? You know, how long I stood in the butcher's queue or the bread queue or, you know, what I said to my neighbour. But of course, you know, as we know now, this is the trivial stuff has become the important stuff because that's what isn't logged so much in the official documents and the records. You know, it's fairly easy to get hold of transcripts of important speeches and important official letters and governmental papers and all of that. What's hard to get is the fine points, the detail, that, you know, how the ordinary person lived their lives and what they thought. And that's what all these old letters obviously provide.
But Chris, there was more to the Nellie Blow story than just Certainly.
I mean, Nellie was she was the daughter of Congressman Henry Blow, of St. Louis, and he would go on to become a U.S. minister to Venezuela and Brazil. He was a prominent citizen here in St. Louis, and certainly, you know, the family collected many letters from all their children. And her sister was Susan Blow, who started the first American kindergarten, which started here in St. Louis, too. So it's a very prominent family.
One of the most important people in American education Susan Blow, no question about it. I have to take another break, but very quickly here we have a couple of emails and tweets that we've received on this subject. When my question arose as to what was the most memorable letter you ever received, Tom wrote, "My draft notice, an early winter." 1969. He is not alone in that, believe me. And Sean, in response to the question, "Do you still write letters? Some things require a personal touch. Ransom demands, for example." So our audience at lunchtime has a good sense of humor. We'll continue the conversation with Simon in London. Simon Garfield, the writer of author of the book To the Letter, and Chris Gordon is with us from the Missouri History Museum. Come back. We'll have time to take some of your calls, and we'll listen to an excerpt from another letter from the Missouri History Museum when we come back. Our call number, by the way, as you should know, is 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Well, you can send us an email if you like. We'll take it that way at talk@stlpublicradio.org. And, of course, we'll take a tweet at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation on the art of letter writing. Some people are calling that the lost art of letter writing, and one of those is Simon Garfield, author of the book To the Letter. He is joining us by long line from London. With me in studio is Chris Gordon from the Missouri History Museum. Before we get back to that next letter from the museum, I want to bring in Tom calling from South St. Louis. Tom, thank you for waiting. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Don. I'm very concerned about my letters getting to their destination in a reliable manner. You mentioned the Postal Service, and it's interesting. At the same time that letter writing is decreasing, shopping by Internet and delivery by mail is increasing. And the other thing that seems to be contributing to the demise of the post office is the mania for privatization. And what I wanted to ask your guests is, I remember as a kid there were these sort of antique notions that literacy, reliable mail delivery, and passable roads were sort of defining hallmarks of civilization. And maybe I'm becoming an old curmudgeon, but I have the impression that we're losing ground on all those areas. And what I wonder is, how did someone like Ben Franklin get the idea that the Postal Service should be in our Constitution and that it is part of a civilized society.
Well, we have two historians here. Let's see if we can get an answer to that question. Chris, do you have an answer?
Well, certainly, you know, correspondence was a lifeline. You had to have a good postal service. You had to have good roads to carry those postmen across the country. And so at that time, it was something that was absolutely a necessity. With technology, certainly all that's changing, and we can do things a little bit more efficiently slightly less investment maybe in some areas.
Simon, the Postal Service or a version of it was nothing new in Franklin's time. I mean, in Elizabethan England, they had an equivalent, did they not?
Exactly, yeah. The postal system as we understand it, you know, dates back much longer than the postage stamp and the 1840s. Goes all the way back to Henry VIII, really, who established the first postal system over here. And it was just, as your caller said, the key was kind of good roads, really. And there were a lot of roads established and regarded as fast roads, really. You know, that was your first class to delivery road, and you had to pay more to be on that. Essentially, what it meant in Henry VIII's time was that you had to be incredibly rich, and if not part of the royal court, then certainly a major landowner. No one else got a look into the postal system there. But I mean, for now, I would say that for the equivalent of the good road is the good broadband system, the good Wi-Fi, and that's. You know, in a way, that's obviously what it's become. I can give you a personal note over here that, you may be aware that the British postal system, the Royal Mail, which dates back to Henry VIII's time, that's why it's called the Royal Mail, was privatized recently. A lot of people made a lot of money very quickly on it, and we don't know about the future of deliveries. You know, it's sort of they've been guaranteed for a certain amount of years. But I was very interested to read that, and you can update me on this about the threat to Saturday deliveries in the U.S. Have they ceased yet, or has that axe been?
No, they abandoned that idea. It was to have started in August, as I recall, and they. Relented and decided to continue it. But they're increasing the price of a first-class stamp by 3 cents, I think, in a matter of weeks. So that's the way they make up for it. I was always told growing up that in England in the 40s and the 50s, you could send an order to the butcher by mail in the morning and have that order delivered in the afternoon. That's how good the system was.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and even before then, in the 1870s and 1880s, we had five or six different mail deliveries every day. So it was the equivalent, almost, of a text. You could send, say, well, listen, I'm really sorry, I forgot my briefcase or something in the morning. And then 2 hours later, someone would get the delivery and then send it on. And then you could say thank you. And then, an extraordinary thing. I mean, that is obviously long gone, and not that long ago. I can still clearly remember when we had not only two deliveries a day, but we had a very efficient Sunday postal system. That's obviously gone. And but your caller is right. I read that, and tell me if I read this incorrectly, that the only efficient Sunday service that you'll get in the next few weeks is from Amazon,
right.
Which I think is going to sort of make special delivery. So that exactly tells you the way things are going. I mean, the one good thing about that is, in a way, is that the online orders of not just Amazon, but all the other stuff we order online is in a way, safeguarding the what we would regard as high postage, but actually means that it's subsidizing, I suppose, the postal system that we understand it from the old days. You know, it's keeping that alive.
You know, we're bouncing around the centuries here, as it were, in this discussion about mail. But I want to go back to the 19th century, because we do have this clip that I want Chris to explain. Basically, it's written during the Civil War, and the writer is Alfred Hartwell. Who was he and what was he writing?
Alfred Hartwell was the commander of the 55th Massachusetts, and he was writing back to Washington asking that his men receive equal pay.
He was an instructor at Washington University at one time.
That's correct.
And his men, but his men, African-American soldiers as well. Let's listen. Alex Hoyer, our producer, is reading this one.
My dear Eaton, the rain again. It comes down in floods when it comes at all. The days and weeks pass by with little variety and great dullness. Now and then a picket is gobbled up, or we take a secesh prisoner or Indian, or their cavalry come around and we turn out and exchange salutations. My regiment is still in three portions, and only half of it with me, a great injury, of course, to its efficiency. The companies here are in good condition, and, in spite of little opportunity for drill in the last 2 months, they are said to march, handle their rifles and tin better than any here. But the great outrage of withholding their pay continues, and the distress of the men is getting almost too great for endurance. Here is a regiment enlisted by the written promise of the Secretary of War to Governor Andrew that they should have the pay and rations and treatment of white troops, that promise being repeated to them by us all and to this day not made good. I am sometimes almost in despair and am indignant and sometimes think evil of all mankind when I see and feel this gross injustice. The men are dying by disease and bullets. Their families are often refused admittance to the almshouses for their color, and in some cases that I have been informed of, their wives have proved unfaithful and have been reduced to infamy from destitution. Can flesh and blood stand these things? I do not know how my men have so patiently and nobly performed every task and duty assigned to them so far, but this they cannot continue long unless they are righted. And here are men who talk largely of their efforts for colored men and go to work ostensibly to get the pay for them, but rally behind their own detestable axes. Friend, there is much that one sees in the army to make him either a knave or as ugly and suspicious as a wild beast.
That's Alex Hoyer reading a letter from Alfred Hartwell back in 1861 during, of course, the Civil War. There are a lot of things there, Chris Gordon, a lot of things in that excerpt that we heard.
Exactly. And the letter is very interesting because it actually almost authenticates, thank you, a scene from the movie Glory. If your viewers have seen that movie, they will perhaps remember a scene in which Robert Shaw, the commander of the 54th Massachusetts, which was a U.S. colored regiment that was organized in Boston. Shaw was the commander of that unit. He stands before his men and rips up his pay stub and says that he's not going to accept his pay unless his men are paid the same as the white troops. And this is reflected in Hartwell's letter as well, that they are pleading with Washington for equal pay for their men.
And the letter was written to Lucian Eaton, who was an abolitionist well-known at the time. So it was a receptive audience to which the letter was directed. Any thoughts from you, Simon, before I go back to the phones?
Yeah, I mean, I found that really fascinating. And then he goes on to say, you know, there are not many people here I can confide in. And I mean, not in these words, but I'm paraphrasing. He says, you know, and I'm writing to you because, you know, I need to put this down in black and white. And it's clear, you know, reading between the lines as one does, he is as mad. He's mad as hell with the conditions. You know, he sort of says, well, I'm making the best of it. But actually, he is mad at the fact that the troops haven't got their money and, you know, he's kind of half bored and the time he isn't bored, he's furious. And amazing letter, I think.
And once again, a long letter. Let's go to the – and we just, of course, played an excerpt from it. Let's go back to the phones. I want to bring in Barbara calling from St. Louis. Barbara, thank you for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I've recently come across a trove of letters from my great aunt who served with Jewish Relief Agency in Germany, helping displaced Jews after World War II. So I have among her letters, letters asking for, can you please find this person? Some of them are in German. Also, I have testimonies she's taken from people. They are crumbling in my hands as I'm trying to put them in plastic sleeves. So I want to know, first of all, you know, what's the best way to preserve them? And second of all, how can I make sure that they find their way to a museum or a resource where they can be connected with other people whose families were victims?
I would definitely contact the Holocaust Museum here in St. Louis. But, Chris, go ahead. What would your advice be to her?
Was your aunt a St. Louis native or?
No, she was a New York City native, and she was a social worker, and she went with the United Jewish Relief Agency. I even have, she saved everything. I have her contract, I have her hotel receipts. I mean, I have everything. She's the best kind of hoarder, and so I have everything from the mundane, you know, to the really, really serious and unbelievable. And I just feel that these are really important historical documents.
Yes, I think I would contact the U.S. Holocaust Museum. I'm sure they would be interested in that. But as far as preserving the letters, you know, just I would leave them in their envelopes and handle them as little as possible. And certainly talk to an archivist there, and they could give you, you know, all the guidance that you would need to get them to the museum.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Barbara, thank you so much for the call. Good luck with that. You really got something there, I think. Turning to World War II, Simon, come back to you. Our time is becoming more and more limited, obviously, but you have a wonderful series of letters in your book from a couple. What are the names? Bessie and Chris. Just briefly tell us what that's all about, and they're just wonderful reading. Talk about two people in love and expressing it so well.
Yeah, I was very keen and very conscious when I was writing the book that I was looking at a lot of famous people's letters. You know, so the Nellie Bloh letter that we heard, it could be that, you know, if her family hadn't been as well connected and if they hadn't led as significant lives as they did, that we wouldn't have her letter because, you know, it would have been charked away as something unimportant. And so I was kind of very keen that I would have a sequence of letters that came from people who were not well known. And purely, really by luck, I called up a friend who is at this mass observation archive that I mentioned. And I said, look, you know, do we have anything new? And she said, we received 2 weeks ago, this is when I was writing the book, obviously, this fantastic sequence of letters from a British postman who served in the war from 1943 to 1945 in North Africa and Greece. And I went down there the next day and said, this sounds extraordinary. And it really was extraordinary. For the main reason that he got very bored. He wasn't seeing any action, which he was grateful for. But he thought, well, how am I going to spend my time? I'm going to write letters. So he wrote to all his friends. And one woman, who, as you say, called Bessie, who he used to work with at the post office, but they'd never been sort of terribly close friends, wrote back and said, well, actually, Chris, it's great to get your letter. And by the way, I've always had a thing for you. Mm-hmm. And within about 3 weeks, they are writing the most intimate letters to each other. Within another, I don't know, few months, they decide to get engaged. And then married, and they do meet, I should say, once before they actually do get married. But all their, you know, flowering of passion and intimacy and understanding happens through the correspondence. So I tell that through the book, and it is an extraordinary thing. And fortunately, and you read it, you know, as a kind of a bit of a thriller. You know, how's this going to turn out? Fortunately, it turns out well because, and we know this because the letters were donated by their two sons, and both Bessie and Chris died about 10 or 15 years ago, and they were very happy for their letters to be to be seen and read now by a wider audience.
We'll have to refer people to a book to get the full story of Bessie and Chris, by the way. The book is To the Letter. It's written by Simon Garfield, our guest, and we're talking to him while he is in London, where he lives. The To the Letter is subtitled A Celebration of the Lost Art of Letter Writing. By the way, I would like to direct you to our website at stlpublicradio.org. If you're interested in the things that we've been talking about here today, in particular, those letters that are now housed at the St. Louis Missouri History Museum, go to our website. You'll be able to hear an audio track of those letters. You'll be able to see the letters in text form, and you'll also be able to see a graphic, a photograph, if you will, of the actual letter itself, at least a page or two of those letters. Very interesting to look at the handwriting and look at the texture of the paper and everything else, Chris. It's a nice collection.
Yeah, and I'd like to, you know, let everyone know that there are many other letters, certainly interesting letters, that you can come to the Missouri History Museum Library and Research Center and look through them yourself. We're open to the public.
All right, Chris Gordon, thank you so much for being with us and sharing
thank
all
you.
Of that with us. Simon Garfield, thank you. Good luck with the book. It's a fascinating read.
Well, that's very kind, Don, and I really enjoyed talking to you.
Same here. And join us tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air. You'll hear my discussion with novelist Amy Tan about her new book, The Valley of Amazement, recorded this past Saturday at the St. Louis County Library. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.